Today is Monday, August 17th, and this is Issues and Ideas on KCBX. We take you behind the news and into local culture to help us better understand this beautiful and complex Central Coast that we all share. I'm Gabriela Fernandez. In the past month, Colombia, Mexico, and Indonesia have all had earthquakes measuring 7.3 or above. This has some Californians wondering how the next big one here could shake out.
When we look at really long records of earthquakes from paleoseismology and we put together the inter-event times between them, the likelihood of an earthquake, given that it hasn't happened yet, that hazard just keeps climbing year after year. So it's not overdue, it just becomes a little more due every passing year.
That's UC Davis geology professor Mike Oskin speaking with CAP Radio's Vicky Gonzalez about what a future earthquake could look like. If the question is not if, but when the next big one will strike, then how should Central Coast residents prepare for earthquakes and other natural disasters? San Luis Obispo emergency manager Joe Little walked me through the steps and even gave me the essentials to put in a go bag.
If you have rental or lease agreements, things like that, if you have more time to kind of get a binder together, fill that thing up. Put all the information you need in there, put that in your tote, you got it in one place. If you have a family, whatever documentation you need for them, their medication, prescriptions, things like that, where you can access it.
And then we'll wrap up the show in Morro Bay with producer Tom Wilmer and Larry Newland on what visitors can find at the Maritime Museum on the Embarcadero.
Well, we're sitting on the vessel Alma. This was launched in 1927, and this is kind of the signature vessel, almost a signature artifact of the museum. It's on our logo. It's carved on the front door. And it was an iconic waterfront feature from 1939 all the way till now.
All this coming up next. A magnitude 7.9 earthquake struck San Francisco in 1906, leading to a fire that lasted several days and destroyed over 80% of the city. Often referred to as the Big One, the 1906 earthquake left an indelible mark in the minds of Californians and the surrounding terrain and left many wondering about the next one. As heard on CAP Radio's Insight with Vicky Gonzalez, UC Davis geology professor, Mike Oskin discusses his recent presentation, Earthquakes in California, What Might the Next Big One Be Like?
The natural beauty of California is on full display no matter where you are in the state. From the agricultural bounty of the Central Valley to the stunning peaks of the Sierra Nevada, the story of California is often told through its landscapes. But that topography also tells another tumultuous story when looked at through the eyes of a geologist. A magnitude 7.9 earthquake struck San Francisco in 1906, leading to a fire that lasted several days and destroyed over 80% of the city. Often referred to as the Big One, the 1906 earthquake left an indelible mark in the minds of Californians and the surrounding terrain. The impact left behind on the landscape can be used to track the history and patterns of earthquakes in California, even informing us about what the future could look like. That is the topic of a talk being given tomorrow by UC Davis geology professor Mike Oskin, titled Earthquakes in California, What Might the Next Big One Be Like? And he joins us now with a preview. Welcome.
Thank you.
Yeah, happy to have you. Thanks for taking the time. So, Professor Oskin, before we get into the talk that you're going to be holding tomorrow, it'd be great to learn more about you and your work. When did you first become interested in geology?
I became interested in geology as a teenager. I spent a lot of time outdoors. My parents liked fishing and I didn't, so I looked at rocks. And then I went to college and had a choice between engineering and geology and tried the geology route and discovered that was the place for me and never looked back.
And the rest is history. And now you're teaching it to students. I mean, when you were a student at UCLA, you had a firsthand experience with earthquakes around that time. The 1994 Northridge earthquake struck Southern California. Was that a formative experience for you that would shape your passion and what you wanted to do professionally?
It was. That earthquake rearranged my apartment. I was, I think, a junior at the time. And then a couple of years before that, there was the Landers earthquake in the Mojave Desert. And I happened to be hiking with my friends in the nearby mountains. And we felt that one very close. And we felt the Big Bear aftershock right beneath us. And it was so violent, we could not even stand up. So I gained an appreciation for the power of earthquakes. And I always had a fascination with topography. And when I went to graduate school, I was able to start putting those two things together.
Hmm. For someone who hasn't experienced an earthquake, I'm from Southern California, so I have. I also was around during the Northwood earthquake as well with my family. But I have, you know, some friends out of state, and it's hard for them to wrap their head around, you know, what an earthquake is and the devastation that it can cause. How do you explain that? I mean, when compared to other natural disasters?
Oh, well, there's a lot to answer there, but I think to start with is that a large earthquake that's close to you is a very frightening event. The shaking is really strong, and it's really not something you want to go through. When I get students that are just gung-ho about it and they want to feel their first one, I'm like, well, are you sure? Because it can be very frightening and cause a lot of damage. Now, in California, we construct things well. You're not likely to perish in an earthquake or be injured. You're more likely to be really inconvenienced by the outcome. It's most likely to rearrange the contents of your residence. So there's a lot of things you can do for your safety that are important. But yeah, just to start with.
Just the tip of the tip of the iceberg. You know, there's a lot of us who are science curious, but we're not full-on geologists like yourself. Talk to us about your research.
A lot of what I do these days involves working with high-resolution topography. So over the last 20 years or so, this technology called LIDAR has kind of just become ubiquitous. And now we have LIDAR scans of much of the country. And that high-resolution topographic image of the ground reveals active faults that in detail you could not see before. You can even strip away the vegetation and see them under the trees. And the landscape is a geological record, and the fault, when it slips in each earthquake, alters that record. And you can record the earthquake history over time from that. And so I've done a lot of work trying to understand how faults slip, how that slip varies along the fault, and how that relates to the sizes of earthquakes. And then the other piece of this puzzle that's important is a study called paleoseismology, where you excavate across a fault and try to get a record of the past earthquakes. And so what I'm going to be talking about tomorrow is really a little bit about how we put these two things together to understand what are the large earthquakes like and how much do they vary from one to the next.
How many fault lines do we have in the state?
Oh,
too many to count.
uncounted. But when you count the ones that are really matter, the ones that slip several millimeters a year or more, it's of the order 10.
Mm. When we hear the phrase, the big one, I think many people often think of an earthquake and a big one, of course. That's why that's the phrase that's used. But as a geologist, when you say big one or when you hear that, like, what does that mean? Because it maybe it's a useful term to visualize, but of course, it's not a scientific term.
Yes. When I think of the big one, I think of the earthquakes that accomplish the most work. So the large events are really what do most of the work of moving the plates. And so you have to have them. They're inevitable. And we see that. We see the loading of faults today. We can measure slip rates over time from the landscape, and we see that those balance out. The second piece of that is the big one is a matter of location. It's really important how close you are to it. So we've built some large cities on our main active faults. And so if that part of the fault ruptures in an earthquake, that's going to be the big one event, right? Another thing that we've been learning from trying to put together these records is that probably the next big one will not be as large as the last one. 1906 was a giant, and it ruptured the whole northern San Andreas. And that's unusual. Most of the time, the San Andreas Fault and other faults in California tend to have partial ruptures. They don't rupture the whole length. They'll rupture some stretch of it. And that produces still a large earthquake that's destructive, but it doesn't do as much work. And that means that they happen more frequently.
You're listening to KCBX's Issues and Ideas on 90.1 FM. CAP Radio's Vicky Gonzalez is speaking with UC Davis professor Mike Oskin about how California's next big earthquake could shake out. And now back to the show.
So So diving into your talk a little bit, you're breaking it up into four main points, and you just touched upon them. But the first point will be that the big one is inevitable. How can you draw that conclusion?
That comes to this work argument. The big earthquakes really do most of the job of releasing the strain on faults. And the small ones just don't do enough. And so then, therefore, the big ones are inevitable in that regard.
Mm. One of your other points focuses on the location, where that could actually be. I mean, our coverage area at CAP Radio is pretty broad. I mean, we cover, of course, this greater Sacramento area, but also the North State, parts of the Central Valley, Tahoe, and Northern Nevada. I mean, what risks do these areas have when it comes to the next big one?
Well, it varies quite a bit across California, and it does correspond broadly to where the topography is, because faults over the long term have built the mountain ranges in this state. So the Central Valley is this big, flat, slowly subsiding basin. The earthquake hazard here is not zero, but it's much lower than in the Bay Area, for example, where the San Andreas Fault and its main friends pass through, like the Hayward Fault. Likewise, as we head east to the east side of the Sierra Nevada, that's another zone of higher rates of activity and higher hazard. Mm. So we're kind of in this low zone, this island of lower hazard, but it's still not zero. You can go to Winters, just near Davis here, and see damage from an earthquake in 1892, still in the buildings that was repaired afterward.
Right. And if there was, say, a big one that was maybe 60 miles away or 70 miles away, I mean, even though we're considered in a relatively like low risk zone, we could still be impacted by that, correct?
Yes, we can be impacted in a number of ways. Primary way is just that's going to be disruptive to the economy, and there's going to be damage and perhaps a need for a response and people that need to be relocated. And the recovery takes years. The shaking could cause damage, but that far away, it would be a little bit unusual. But there are weak elements of infrastructure, like levees in the delta, that people worry about collapsing in an earthquake. And so it's still important to be far away. It still impacts further away, I should say.
Mm. I want you to expand upon something you said, that, you know, the next big one is inevitable. But earlier you said that it likely will be smaller than big ones that we've experienced. How are you able to draw that conclusion?
That conclusion comes from looking at the rates of slip and the earthquake history in combination. And one facet of it is that the earthquakes are too frequent to be all like 1906, because the larger the earthquake, the more slip it produces. And what we find is there's just more, they happen more often than to be giants like that all the time.
Hmm.
The second thing is that when you look at records, multiple records on the same fault, and we have better data for this in Southern California than in the North, but when you try to correlate those records, a lot of the earthquakes don't match. And that's another piece of evidence that tells you that a lot of those events were partial ruptures. So you put those together, the story is that the fault tends to rupture in partial breaks, not the entire fault unzipping from one end to the other, except very rarely.
So I'm from Southern California, and I've heard this a bunch, but I think you call this a misconception. I have heard that we're overdue for the next big earthquake, but you argue that's not the right way to look at it. Why?
Yes, this is one of the main points I want to make tomorrow, and that when we look at really long records of earthquakes from paleoseismology and we put together the inter-event times between them, what jumps out right away is the earthquake machine is not very regular. It's not like a clock, right? And so therefore, things don't cluster around the mean. There's a whole range of inter-event times from short to long. And when you look a little more closely at that distribution, what it indicates is that the hazard, the likelihood of an earthquake, given that it hasn't happened yet, that hazard just keeps climbing year after year. So it's not overdue. It just becomes a little more due every passing year.
You're listening to KCBX's Issues and Ideas on 90.1 FM. CAP Radio's Vicky Gonzalez is speaking with UC Davis professor Mike Oskin about how California's next big earthquake could shake out. And now back to the show.
So there are some limitations. I mean, one of the things I don't think you can answer is when, right? I mean, that's a big question mark. That's like $1 million answer if you could reach that. Why is it difficult to actually like hone in on when it could happen?
Yes, that's a really challenging problem for a number of reasons. And the most important one is that the process of where earthquakes nucleate happens 10 miles down in the crust in California, and it's a very small scale process. And so there's been attempts to try to instrument faults like the San Andreas and Parkfield and detect some precursors, and they were unsuccessful. It's just too small. We also don't understand, once an earthquake starts, what stops it. So it's hard to also predict how far it's going to go, whether it's going to be a moderate size one or a big one. So you put those two things together, and it's essentially an unpredictable problem to sort of identify over the short term. Now, over the long term, we have this record, and we can say something about the probability and the likelihood, right? So, you know, over the lifetime, say, of a mortgage on your house, we have a better idea of what's likely to happen. And then over the really short term, once an earthquake starts, we have earthquake early warning, because now we have the technology to identify that this is probably something big, and we should send out an advance notice that the earthquake waves are coming. But in that case, the earthquake's already started. We're just able to move the signal out faster than the earthquake waves.
And this is just a little preview. Do you enjoy getting out of the classroom and talking to people about your work?
I do. I don't do it very frequently, but I do enjoy it. I do enjoy the outreach. I think that the more knowledge we have about hazards like this, the better prepared we are. And it's just interesting.
Professor Oskin, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you.
That was CAP Radio's Vicky Gonzalez speaking with geology professor Mike Oskin about what California's next major earthquake could be like. You're listening to KCBX's Issues and Ideas on 90.1 FM. We'll be right back. We've just heard how a major earthquake could unfold in California. We now go to a conversation I had late last week with the city of San Luis Obispo's emergency manager, Joe Little. We talked about how to prepare for any number of emergencies that could arise in California and on the Central Coast.
Is there a particular disaster scenario that just keeps you up at night?
The ones I worry about the most involve cascading effects. So it's not just one thing, it's the aftermath of those things. Extreme heat / prolonged power outage is one of my biggest worries. It does distress folks. We have an older population. We have an unhoused population who are susceptible to whatever's going on outside. A lot of people here in SLOE, we're fortunate enough to have a lot of seniors that may, and everyday folks who need, you know, things to be refrigerated, like their medication, that type of thing, food, resources. So you start to see those cascading effects. It gets pretty nerve-wracking. And then wildfire is always one. Earthquake's always there, but wildfire, past the human impact, the horrible impact we see right now in Northwest United States, but you're seeing communities destroyed. You're seeing the economy is destroyed for years. It doesn't come back. The services that the folks who have come to rely on, that tax base is no longer there to support. So those things are very scary, those cascading effects. When we have things locally, you know, we were fortunate enough last year with a Gifford fire. The winds didn't really put a whole bunch of smoke into SLOE. But had it done that, the concern is for folks with respiratory concerns. And again, we have an older population. We have unhoused population. Immediately, those folks can become medically distressed, and we're going to have to deal with that. So, like, there's these cascading effects that we see one issue, but it's all the stuff that comes with it. And so trying to get ahead of that.
So how can the average resident be prepared for any of those cascading effects or emergencies?
So right off the bat is you're signed up for public alerting. Most of us have cell phones, and they kind of come defaulted with the wireless emergency alert, or WEA, as we like to acronym things as a WEA. And that's where you see like an amber alert, or you'll see, you know, potentially related to evacuations and things like that. There are other public alerting that we want you to always be signed up for. Here in San Luis Obispo County specifically, we want you to be signed up for Alert Slow. And that's through the County Office of Emergency Services. Just search Alert Slow. There's also Reverse 911. Sign up for those so you're informed. We can tell you what's going on. Secondly, having a plan in place to evacuate. Whether it's for earthquake and you need to relocate for a couple days, stay at a friend's house, or stay in a shelter or a hotel, to already have your go bag packed with the items you're going to need. You're going to need, if I told you, hey, in 3 days, you got to evacuate your house and you're going to go live in a parking lot for a couple days, you're probably going to have a pretty good list built up. Do that and go make yourself a go bag. You do those things, your chances of making this process easier goes through the roof. It's when we're scrambling, we're taking too long, and we're late to the evacuation that trouble can start. Having a plan for your pets, having a plan for the medications you take, you need to make sure that you have a way to transport those things safely, especially if they had to be refrigerated, like insulin, things like that. So you can do those things. Right off the bat, it's going to help out. Storing water at your home, old school, you know. For cooking and for hygiene, it's 3 gallons per person per day. Generally speaking, I would say, you know, having a few cases of bottled water is great. Make sure you rotate through it. But do those things in advance. And if you have all that done, you don't have to get ready. You're already ready. We are on a little island here where we live. It kind of goes from, let's say, Builton to San Miguel. That's our little island. And what we have there is what we're going to have in case we have any kind of regional disaster. That type of thing is going to tax our ability to receive gasoline. It's going to tax our ability to receive outside assistance. So the more you can do to kind of support yourself in that, you know, your car is full, your batteries are charged, your go bag's ready, you got some extra water, you got some extra food. Doing those things to kind of help yourself along goes a long way, and it also doesn't strain our system. So that's my best advice.
Is there an item that people most often forget to pack in their go bag?
It's medication, for sure. Think of the things that we're going to encounter. If we have a wildfire or earthquake, we're going to have particulate matter in the air, right? We don't want to breathe in that stuff in, especially if we have respiratory problems. So those masks we got during COVID are going to work great for removing particulate matter from the air and keeping you a little more safe during that time. All your toiletries, whatever you're going to need during the week for a week of life, just imagine you're going to need that when you have to evacuate. So if you have those things, that's great. But yeah, medication, I think people kind of forget that they're going to need stuff. Or they think they're going to be able to get it from a pharmacy. We don't know if that's going to happen.
And how much water should people realistically keep at home for these emergencies?
I would keep per person, just grab a case of water. So if you got 2-3 people in a house, have 2-3 cases of water, we're talking not very much money invested in that. And it can be used for things like obviously drinking, for cooking, and for sanitation.
And what documents should people have copies of, you think?
All the typical stuff. If you can have a copy of your birth certificate, having all your credit card information and all the numbers you're going to have to be able to call to renew cards, things like that, your bank account information, vehicle registration, driver's license, if you have a passport, anything that's going to prove identity, that's a huge thing to have. If you have rental or lease agreements, things like that, if you have more time to kind of get a binder together and fill that thing up, put all the information you need in there, put that in your tote, you got it in one place. If you have a family, whatever documentation you need for them, their medication, prescriptions, things like that, where you can access it. A lot of that stuff is available to us on our phones now. Let's have a backup to the backup, right? So if you rely on your phone, have a paper backup of that stuff.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX and the City of San Luis Obispo's emergency manager, Joe Little, on how to prepare for natural disasters and other emergencies.
Any advice on how people should prepare for their pets?
Making sure that you have plenty of, you know, food for your pets and they have enough for several days. We do have pet sheltering here in this county, whether it's a house pet, horse, cow, we have places for them to go. And we have some resources that are available through different groups for transporting larger animals. If your pet likes certain things, have enough with them, if they're on any special diet, or their pets are on medication. So make sure that you have all those stuff ready to go, or it's part of your evacuation. If the stuff's in the fridge, you know, put a note on top of your go bag to go grab that stuff.
During an earthquake, how can people prepare for the possibility of, like, electricity or water or cell service failures or road closures in the area?
As long as we have cell connection, we're going to put that information out. Hey, there's road closures here, there, and give folks a better plan or better, at least, situation awareness of where we're wanting them to evacuate to, if we have you evacuate at all. But the majority of the time with a lot of the stuff, we're going to have you shelter in place. That's the best plan, because resource-wise, you know, just because it's an earthquake doesn't mean you leave your house, but as long as it's structurally safe, you're okay to stay there. But being able to know what's going on, whether it's through your cell phone, whether it's through the radio, like, you know, KCBX, great example of a place folks are probably, who are accustomed to listening to the radio, they're going to turn on because it's a local station. We value that immensely. And so the information is going to be pushed out to our local broadcasters. If you have battery power, things that you need to survive, that you're going to want to have, having a battery backup, they sell little solar things now to charge stuff. Those are great. If you're going to have anything to do, though, with lithium ion batteries in your home, make sure they're from a reputable source. You're not getting them on Temu. You're not getting them at the swap meet. They have Underwriters Laboratory listing on them, because we've had a lot of fires here that involved lithium ion batteries that were either damaged or they just showed up and they were substandard. Having plenty of water ready to go, having your go bag, having some food supply, those basic steps go a long way.
You mentioned lithium ion batteries. I'm just generally curious about this. Is that like a huge concern for emergency service teams right now in terms of like wildfires spreading?
Nuanced question. So when we respond to wildfires, you know, generally if they're out in the open space, we're not too concerned about it. The very second it hits any structure or a vehicle, and those things somehow involve lithium-ion batteries, it's a heightened risk to our responders, because when those things catch on fire, they put out smoke that's very toxic, to the point where we have to send the turnouts that are exposed to it, the equipment that firefighters wear, has to be scrubbed and decontaminated on site and then sent off to specialty cleaners, because it's so full of heavy metals that are extraordinarily toxic to the firefighters who already have problems in their industry with cancers. So we are very, very cognizant of that. When it gets into the neighborhoods, all bets are off. You're burning everything in the house. And look at everything's made out of plastic. Everything's made out of these materials that once they're lit, they're putting off heavy metals, toxic gases, you know, volatile organic compounds. Those things are terrible for first responders and for the public at large. So we worry about it in that regard, but they've just been in regular old fires, whether it's a vehicle fire or house fire, and it's injured people. Even just here in San Luis Obispo, we've had enough cases where they're like, oh, hey, we need to do some public education about this. Which last year and this year, National Fire Prevention Week, educating folks around lithium-ion batteries.
And wildfires can move extremely quickly. How do you decide when it's time to issue an evacuation warning or evacuation order?
Great question. So we're looking at things like the rate of spread. If I know in a zone, and San Luis Obispo City has 33 zones, all the municipalities here in Slo County and the unincorporated areas of the county, they're all zoned out. We have zones set up in those, and they're based off population density. So we can look and see this zone, according to our plans, our pre-plans, and our past experience. Let's say it takes an hour to evacuate this zone. If I'm looking at rate of spread on a fire, and I know how fast it's going based off wind, based off fuel type, vegetation, and I say, I've got an hour of space before that fire is here, I'm going to put an evacuation order right away. The more time I have, I can issue warnings, especially based off of the wind direction, some of the firefighting activity that's happening, and whether we're getting containment on the fire. It's never something we do lightly as evacuations go, because we know the disruption to life it is. Yeah, we're looking at things like topography, wind speed, fuel type, firefighting activity, population density, how long it takes to evacuate an area. All those factors go into when we decide to do a warning or do an evacuation order.
And can you explain what the difference is between an evacuation warning and an evacuation order, and how people should handle each one?
Yeah, so evacuation warning just means, hey, we're looking at your area right now, and based off the conditions that we see, there's a potential we're going to have to evacuate you. It gives folks a little bit of head start on getting their go bag ready. You have more time so you can get more stuff. And I tell people, have a 5-minute plan, a 30-minute plan, an hour plan, right? 5 minutes is you're running through your house as fast as you can to get just the basic necessities of what you need, or your go bag, your go to that's already pre-done, and you're bailing out. If I give you 30 minutes, well, now we can kind of be selective. We can do some things we need to do, maybe do some things at our home that we can kind of make it a little more fire resistant, like moving potted plants and things like that away, flammable items away from our house. We have a little time. You got an hour, you got even more time. An evacuation order means you're going right now. Like, I don't care what your condition is, you got to get out, because we think that the fire is coming so quickly that there's a potential it's going to overwhelm your neighborhood. So you got to go. You got to leave. And don't wait for us. Just get out. You get the order, leave. We also tell people, don't wait for the order. If you get an evacuation warning and you're comfortable with what you have, your family's accounted for, your pets is accounted for, you have everything that you think you're going to need to go and be okay in a parking lot someplace, just go. Don't wait for us. You know, the more people we can get out before the order is done, the less time it's going to take to evacuate.
And how can someone find out what evacuation zone they live in?
There's a few places. If you want to go to the County Office of Emergency Services, there is zone mapping on their page for the entire county. City of San Luis Obispo, if you go to slowcity.org/wildfire, navigate through that page and you will come to a zone map, and it will show you one of the 33 zones we have in San Luis Obispo City. If you're curious about yours, go to the County Office of Emergency Services website. Google is your friend and it'll get you right there.
Are there plans in place for people who don't have cars, or people with disabilities, older residents, or just people who need additional time for evacuation?
Yeah, so we have transportation agreements with transit here in the city of San Luis Obispo. Additionally, we can request assistance from RTA, other organizations here in town, to remove, we call it a carless population, which we are seeing more and more of. You know, folks, they're using public transportation more. They're using other forms of transportation like biking, things like that. So they don't have a car. And so we're having to account for that. So we'll set up designated evacuation points. And that's where that public alerting is very important, to be able to listen to that. We're going to say, hey, carless populations, go to this location for transport out. Additionally, with folks who need evacuation assistance due to a medical reason or some other reason, the County Office of Emergency Services does maintain a list of folks who need that additional assistance. Initially, it's put out for the Diablo Canyon evacuation planning. It can be used for anything. We have that information. So we have that information. So if in case of that, if you're signed up for that, we're going to see it on our end. Again, that's a countywide thing. We see it in our jurisdiction in San Luis Obispo, but anybody can sign up for that. We are in communication with residential care facilities, skilled nursing facilities, things like that. So, you know, they need to have an emergency operations plan. We'll coordinate with them, whether it's a shelter in place, or coordinate with them how we're going to get people and where we're going to put them. So we plan for those things. You know, it's important for folks to be either on a list with the County Office of Emergency Services, or at least have the public alerting so we can tell them where to go and what to do.
You're listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX and the City of San Luis Obispo's emergency manager, Joe Little, on how to prepare for natural disasters and other emergencies.
And what should college students or renters or just people who don't think about defensible space or home hardening, what should they be doing to prepare?
I think the best thing any resident can do, whether they're a renter, a homeowner, you live in an apartment, you live in condos, wherever, if you can clear the 5 feet around your home of anything flammable, your home's chances of not catching on fire go up. When we talk about a wildfire moving into town, you know, we're kind of focusing on the brush and the trees and things like that. But what we don't want to have happen is it to catch a house on fire, because a house is, like we kind of talked earlier, full of fuels. Tons of stuff in there is flammable, whether it's a wood frame construction house, you have couches, beds, clothes, carpets, you name it, wood furniture, all that stuff is flammable inside a home. So the second it hits a house, we just have all this fuel to propel a fire and create, you know, what's called an urban conflagration. So if we can stop that fire on the outside, right, we can stop it from getting into a home and create a defensible space. And again, the best thing you could do is remove anything flammable 0 to 5 feet from a home, making sure things like your rain gutters are not full of leaf debris that's very flammable. It's going to burn up into an attic. You don't have to be the homeowner to do that. If you're just a renter, you can make sure your place you live is safer by not storing flammables around a house or clearing the rain gutters, things like that, or communicating that with your landlord. Yeah, there's so many things you can do to a home, whether it's just making sure the ventilation screening on your vents inside of your house are less than 1/8 of an inch, so embers can't get inside your attic. We want to make sure that we're going to do whatever we can on the exterior to protect it from fire.
And onto floods, we had some pretty devastating winter storms and flooding hit the Central Coast area in early 2023 and 2024. What is the biggest mistake people make during flooding?
The biggest one, I'd say, waiting too long to protect their property with sandbags is a biggie. We're going to go into El Nino season. Who the heck knows what that's going to mean as far as how much rain we're going to get, the frequency of storms. It just says that we have the potential for a heightened storm activity. So let's expect it. Right now, we're doing stuff on our end. So what I want homeowners to do is if you live in an area that's flood prone, go and get some sandbags ready. Have them ready, stored. You can just deploy them out as necessary. Do not wait until the day it's raining. The city maintains sand piles. There's one at the corporation yard that's available on our website as well, the other locations, but they're throughout town. I think we have 5 of them where we'll deploy sand. Have those sandbags ready to go. Get them done now while it's nice out and the weather's fine, but waiting too long is a problem. You know, everything you need to do, you've done in advance. We're fortunate here in town that we have kind of a narrow corridor that gets nailed by flooding. It's just the way it is here, just our topography. So we do a lot of work on our end, clearing the creeks out of large debris. You'll still see brush. That's kind of considered lay down brush. Don't get too worked up when you see that stuff. But we're out clearing trees, removing large debris. We've installed the Mid-Higuera bypass off of Bianchi Lane. We replaced a bridge. We did all this work over there and basically created a second channel for the flow to go because we have experienced surcharging, which just means water's traveling back up the creek system because there's nowhere to go. But plan on, hey, we may have to deploy some sandbags around our businesses or our homes. We're going to make sure that we bring in all our stuff in and are covering it up so it doesn't get damaged by rains and that we're keeping our rain gutters clear, keeping our drains around our home clear. Just know, we're going to get rains this year. And the information we're seeing is it's going to be a lot more rain, or a lot more frequency of rain. We don't know if it's going to be intensity, but a continuous raining period. So get ahead of it now. Don't wait until the day it's raining.
Are there certain parts of the city where the risk of flooding is just much higher that residents should know about or be aware of?
There are areas where it's flood prone. We call them, 100-year storms, 50-year storms, 100-year storms, 500-year storms. And it just means the size of the area that's going to be impacted, that's going to be flooded. And so anything that's along Higuera, San Luis Creek, the Higuera corridor, areas out off of Ocean Air near Laguna Lake, they're going to be impacted. During the last storm, we were all very busy during that time, but you could see basically the lake and the houses started to be about the same height. We weren't able to move enough water through town. So a lot of work has been done to fix that. But if we get a high intensity rain in those areas, you may see localized flooding. If you've noticed that there is an area that when it rains, the water collects, then just imagine that's someplace where you could potentially have some standing water, some localized flooding. But we have maps available to the public. And something we'll be pushing out before we get into El Nino season itself is, hey, here's your areas. You're prone to having some localized flooding in this area, so be prepared. Take some action now to prevent running away on you.
What's something you've learned from previous Central Coast emergencies that's changed the way that you personally prepare?
The potential for, again, long-term power outages, it's different in my personal life. I have a small generator that can power our refrigerators and some lights in my house. Fuel's ready to go for that. My almost getting ready to turn 90-year-old mother-in-law lives with us. She's diabetic. She has, some medical issues. We have to plan ahead for her. And so making sure that we have refrigeration so she has her insulin is refrigerated. Easy. That we don't have food spoilage, that we have lights, things like that. So in my personal life, I do that. I know I'm going to be away from home for a while if we do have something here. So I want to make sure that whatever support we need there, they're able to do it themselves.
If someone listening right now realizes they're completely unprepared for an earthquake, wildfire, or flood, what are 3 things you want them to do today?
I want them to sign up for Alert Slow. Go to the internet right now and sign up. If you can't, get a hold of me at the fire station. I'll get you signed up. I want you to go home and get your go bag, your go tote ready to go. Also have one for your car so you can walk home if necessary. Those one and two. And the third thing, I really, really encourage everyone to clear all flammables around their house within 5 feet. If you can do those things, you're setting yourself up for success. You're creating resilience. You are preparing in the right ways. You know, and also, if I could add a fourth thing, make sure they're using all the resources we put out. We put out a ton of information just in just the city of San Luis Obispo alone. But we have Cal Fire around, Five Cities Fire, Paso, Atascadero, right? So if you live in San Miguel, talk to the San Miguel Fire Department because they're going to have information for San Miguel. San Luis Obispo, come talk to us. But reach out to your local fire departments and get their take on it because they're going to have stuff that's going to be individualized for where you live. If you do those things, you're going to have a much, much better end result.
You're listening to KCBX's Issues and Ideas on 90.1 FM. We'll be right back. Next up is Journeys of Discovery with contributor Tom Wilmer. In this segment, Tom heads to the Morro Bay Maritime Museum to visit Larry Newland, the museum's curator and collections manager. Newland offers insights about the Navy rescue submarine featured in the 1990 movie The Hunt for Red October and other nautical artifacts on display.
There's a naval rescue submarine that resides out front, facing the Embarcadero at the Morro Bay Maritime Museum. It's a U.S. Navy DSRV, Deep Submergence Rescue Vehicle, dubbed the Avalon. It was first launched in 1971, along with her sister vessel, the Mystic. The DSRVs are 50 feet long, with a capacity to carry 24 passengers in addition to the crew. Utilizing U.S. Air Force C-5As and C-141 aircraft, the DSRV and its associated equipment and support staff could be dispatched to a port anywhere in the world. The vessels utilize technology and materials derived from the Gemini and Apollo space program. The DSRV was featured in the 1990 movie Hunt for Red October, starring Sean Connery. I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for a visit with Larry Newland at the Morro Bay Maritime Museum to discover the rest of the story, as well as an overview of the Maritime Museum's nautical artifacts. We'll then meet up with four of the former naval crewmen who served aboard the DSRVs. Larry Newland, the reason that I'm here has to do with a deep submergence rescue vessel that you have out front, built by the Navy.
Yeah, we have one of two DSRVs. They were going to build six of these vehicles and put two in three different strategic locations around the world. And of course, they only ended up building two, and they were posted at the Deep Submergence Unit, which is now called Submarine Rescue, on North Island, Coronado Island, in San Diego.
And this was built by Lockheed?
Lockheed Space and Missile, but Lockheed had a division called Ocean Systems. Mm-hmm. And they worked on the Glomar Explorer, and they worked on a lot of things. But this was actually built by Lockheed Space and Missile in Sunnyvale, and then taken to San Diego. They had a lab down there, and they tested it some more.
This vessel became kind of legendary because of a Hollywood movie, Hunt for Red October.
Yeah, if you watch the movie, you'll see a few sections where they're they reference or even point out a DSRV. And what you're looking at in the movie is an 8-foot model that now hangs in the museum up at Keyport, Washington, which is the Naval Undersea Museum at Keyport.
So there were two that were built in the different names.
Yeah, one was the Mystic, after, of course, Connecticut, Mystic Seaport. And one was the Avalon after Catalina. That's the one we had. Originally, they were just DSRV 1 and 2, but then people felt like, oh, we should give them a name. So that's what they did.
You're listening to KCBX's Issues and Ideas on 90.1 FM. Contributor Tom Wilmer is speaking with Larry Newland at the Morro Bay Maritime Museum.
Tell us about the movie Hunt for Red October and how this played a role.
Well, in the movie, of course, they've got to get on board this Russian sub. The DSRVs were designed and engineered to actually mount the aft hatch of a nuclear submarine. What the movie doesn't tell you is that there's a specific design of that aft hatch. In fact, the Navy had a guy that worked full-time going around the world with all the NATO people that bought into the system to inspect and sign off on their hatch, because you could buy into the system so that if you had a submarine disaster, you call on the U.S. Navy and they would come. So it's unlikely that the Russians would have designed their aft hatch. And in fact, when the Kursk went down, DSRV was offered twice and they turned it down.
Yeah, and that was because of ego and
a lot of things. And who knows for sure if that would change today if we had our own system and we offered it to the Russians. I don't know if anything would be any different.
Right. So a question for you is the marrying and matching of the hatches.
Yes.
Did the Russians design their hatches so they would...
Somebody told me once that they went out of their way to actually make it so there was no way that you could mount a DSRV to one of theirs. They have the Akula class and the Foxtrot class, and I can't think of the other classes. It's been a long day, but there were several classes of submarine. And, of course, each side has drawings of the other submarines. We know exactly what it is, and they know exactly what we have. You know, so... No, it was never used on a Russian sub. It was offered once, of course, with the Kursk, but never actually used.
A few weeks ago, you did a fundraiser, and at the Morro Bay Theater,
yes,
you played the movie Hunt for Red October.
Yes.
And I went there, and you had invited naval troops who served on board that vessel and came and talked to us.
They did. Most of these folks, they were in the Navy and they were assigned to the delivery program. So that's the program when a product gets transferred over by the contractor to the military, and they usually assign people. It could be a jet, a fighter jet, or a bomber, or a ship. There's some interface between regular Navy staff and the contractor. And those folks, as I understand it, were part of that delivery crew for both the Mystic and the Avalon, because they were only about a year apart.
So the DSRV is mounted right out front of the Morro Bay Maritime Museum.
It is.
And I imagine that's quite a draw. You have quite a few people that come in, and that's what piques their curiosity.
It is. And we've often been asked, what's the nexus between that thing and any submarine, for that matter, in Morro Bay? And there is one. It's not really obvious, but if you look at our mission statement, it says Maritime History, Science, and Technology. Mm-hmm. And the technology in that submarine, which came out of the Gemini and Apollo space program, epitomizes more than anything late 1960s, early 1970s, Cold War technology. In fact, the computer that's in there to help it mount and land on the aft hatch of a distressed submarine is the same one that they used in the Apollo 11 program to land on the Sea of Tranquility. So it's a similar type of problem. Mm-hmm. You can imagine you're in the black abyss. You can't see anything. You got lights. It's a harsh environment. There could be currents and movement. And you have to land very precisely this big round thing on a large manhole cover. And how do you do that? That's a technical problem, and it was largely solved by Draper Laboratories, which is the laboratory that's affiliated with MIT. They designed the Norton bomb site for World War II.
Oh, wow.
So a big company like Lockheed, they have a project development team, but there's a particular project or a particular problem, they might farm that out to somebody that specializes in that. So they're part of the team. Sitting on the vessel Alma. This was launched in 1927, and this is kind of the signature vessel, almost a signature artifact of the museum. It's on our logo. It's carved on the front door, and it was an iconic waterfront feature from 1939 all the way till now. It came out of the water in the late 90s, around 2000. It was donated in 1995 by the last operator. We're the 10th owner. It was originally built for an Italian immigrant named Joseph Crivello in San Francisco as a fishing boat. And it was run by Standard Oil and Union Oil Company a lot. And
that's how it got down here.
That's how it got down here. It got down here to work in the oil terminal that started in the late 20s off here in Estero Bay.
In a moment about its hero status during the beginning dawning days of World War II.
Yeah, it's got a World War II affiliation, and a lot of people affiliate it as a World War II vessel, but she was a middle-aged girl by the time World War II came. Mm-hmm. In the morning of December 23rd, 1941, she was dispatched. She was dispatched from the Cayucas Pier because of a rumor that a tanker had been attacked by a Japanese submarine, and it had. It was the SS Montebello, and it was a Union Oil tanker, about 450 feet long, steaming from Port San Luis, Vancouver, Washington, full of Santa Maria crude oil. It got hit on the forward starboard side by a long lance type 93 torpedo from the Japanese submarine, the I-21. We have a model of that submarine.
So it had just departed from Avila?
It had just left Avila around midnight. Mm-hmm. And this was like 5:30-ish in the morning. And a couple of guys on the bridge, William Srez and Richard Quincy, saw something that looked like a snorkel or something sticking out of the water, and they said, better go wake the skipper. And he was a 46-year-old Swedish guy named Olaf Engström. And he got up and wiped the sleep out of his eyes and grabbed the glasses and looked at it and said, oh, boy, start zigzagging and head closer to the coast because they'll run aground before we do. And they speeded up to like 10 knots because it's slow. And the submarine came out of the water on its starboard side with a rising sun flag on it. And one of them was remarked that it was a big boy, end quote. And it was. It was 350 feet long, and the tanker was 450 feet long. Wow. And it came alongside, lined up, and fired around at least one. Some people say two, but for sure one, because it hit the starboard side, shook the vessel violently, knocked the radio antenna down, did some cosmetic damage. And shortly thereafter, the captain ordered everybody to abandon ship. And so they got into four lifeboats and waited. The ship did not machine gun the lifeboats, as popular rumor said, but they did fire rounds at the side of the hull. And I know this because I've spoken with Dick Quincy, and he was sitting in a lifeboat. I spoke with him twice, and I have it on tape. He said, no, they fired that big 5-inch deck gun. And you'd see the register from it, and then you'd hear it slam into the hull. You know, they're thousands of miles from home. They're not going to waste a bunch of ammunition and rounds on some merchant marine guys sitting in a lifeboat. They were of a disciplined Navy. They were told to come to the West Coast and wreak a little havoc.
You're listening to KCBX's Issues and Ideas on 90.1 FM. Contributor Tom Wilmer is speaking with Larry Newland at the Morro Bay Maritime Museum.
So that SS Montebello, the tanker, sunk off of Cambria.
Right? Yeah, it's between 4 and 6, south of Piedras Blancas, but north of Cambria.
And it's still on the ocean floor.
880 feet.
With oil.
Probably not. Well, there was an investigation. The Congressman Sam Blakesley, several years ago, sponsored a bill to get Fishing Game to hire a consultant to go down there and core drill through the hull and do some sampling. And they didn't find any remnants of oil. It probably still has bunker fuel in it, which is the fuel for the motor. And who's to say that the oil didn't meter out slowly over the years? But you have to remember also that the oil that you put in a tanker isn't like buying a can of 30 weight at the auto parts store. Mm. It's like tar. And they have to heat it. So it's not going to pour out like motor oil out of a can. And at 880 feet and 50 degrees or 48 degrees, the consistency of that product is not going to be very viscous. Mm-hmm. But who's to say it didn't just meter out, or who's to say that when they did the core samples, they missed it?
Yeah.
So as far as we know, it's not an impending environmental disaster, mm-hmm. but attention was given to that.
Yeah. Before we go, a little bit more about the Maritime Museum, a couple of the other cool things that you have here.
Well, it's been open since 2017. I started with the project in 1992, and it's taken a long time to get to the point where we can actually have this piece of real estate and put it here. We have a building with exhibits inside, and we have a model of the I-21 submarine and the tanker. The I-21 model is probably the best B-class submarine model in the world.
And that's the Japanese.
That's the Japanese submarine. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the tanker, and they're both the same scale, so you can compare them. We have several artifacts, and we cover everything kind of soup to nuts, from 8,000 years ago with the Salinan Indian maritime tradition all the way up to modern commercial fishing. There's a Coast Guard boat, rollover boat here that operated during the 80s. We have the DSRV. So we're a little bit of everything. And so I've always told people, you don't go to a museum like this to get an exhaustive treatment on a subject. Mm-hmm. You go there to provoke thought and to provoke an interest so that maybe you want to go learn some more about something.
To learn more about the Maritime Museum, where's your go-to site?
There's morebaymaritime.org. You can just go there. They're open 7 days a week, 10 to 3. We do tours.
Is there a cost of entry to the museum?
No, it's free. Mm-hmm. It's always free, but we certainly like donations. And I should say that this is 100% volunteer-run nonprofit. There's no money from the city whatsoever, but it's completely run by volunteers. So we're always looking for volunteers. So let me make that pitch, Tom, right now. If there's somebody out there that would like to, even 4 hours a month, that would help. So come on down.
Larry Newland with Morro Bay Maritime Museum. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Tom.
My pleasure.
And that'll do it for this week's show. Our theme song is Soul Sync by Ketsa. You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX 90.1 FM in San Luis Obispo. Thanks to everyone who contributed to this week's program, the team at Cap Radio's Insight, and Tom Wilmer. Today's show was mixed and produced by Emily Harris. Monica Lopez is our executive producer. Brad Kyle is the operations assistant. And I'm this week's host and KCBX assistant news director, Gabriela Fernandez. See you next time.